Ryan.
Hey, Rachel, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm going pretty well. Pretty well. We're back at it again. This is the Yum Yum Podcast, a show in which we, upon our rewatch of the television series Star Trek Discovery, we're on our rewatch and we're breaking it down episode by episode. Rachel, are you excited?
No.
You're not excited?
Yes and no, I suppose would be. Yana?
Yana, as an Australian bravely once said. You said that.
Yeah.
So this is our show, where the Yum Yum Podcast is our show Yum Yum Trek, in which we specialize talking about Star Trek, Discovery in particular. We call the show Yum Yum in the, you know,
in honor and reverence towards the fantastic line from Commander Nahn in season 2, where her response to going into essentially
a battle
against
an evil AI man was
yum yum.
It unified everyone. It was the unifying force in that episode. Everyone, and it unified us.
Yep.
Have you noticed ever since that line came to pass, the world has been a better place since 2019? I mean, it was so much eviler then. Now everything's happy-go-lucky. Everything's a utopia now.
This is episode 11 of season 1 of Star Trek Discovery. And the beautiful synopsis that IMDb delivers for this particular episode, The Wolf Inside.
That's the name of the episode?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I forgot already. Just FYI. I forgot.
Uh-huh. Well, then you're the target demographic for the writers.
Yes!
As the crew continues their guise, Burnham undergoes a merciless mission in hopes of helping the USS Discovery return home. Tilly works on restoring Stamets' neurofunction.
I guess that's the episode. Now,
I disagree with one major thing.
Michael's merciless mission?
It's not merciless. It's she's trying to make sure that they get out alive, which is an act of mercy, not mercilessness.
Rachel, we don't have time, okay? There's so much to cover with this episode. We're just going to say it straight off the bat. We did not like this episode. Rachel and I had a chat just before saying, let's cover the episode in a certain manner because we both are in unity in this regard of this was a very, very bad episode of Star Trek Discovery from our point of view. So instead of just ripping into it straight away, let's start off with our positives. Do we have any? Rachel, do you have any positives from this episode?
Nothing is coming to mind. Maybe if you say something,
Do you really not have anything from this? Because you always have something to counter my negativity, to counter my positivity. You always have something. You are the one who distributes the yum-yums more so on this podcast than I do. And every time I deliver a yum, which means bad, of course, you always grill me in some way, shape, or form, going, but Ryan, you know, there was these things. So how is it that this episode doesn't have anything for you? Nothing? Seriously, nothing?
Nothing leaps out to me right now. I'm sure that there's something in there.
Yeah.
But everything I'm thinking of is like, that could have been good, but it was immediately bad, or it was just always going to be bad.
Okay.
So, but I'm open to being wrong.
Now, I wanted to just say, I'm going to give some positives, and I want you to restrain yourself from instantly countering them with, but it was bad because of this, because we are going to be discussing this episode pretty much all of it as this was bad and this is why it didn't work. But I just want to go through the things that rang true to me, or at least semi-worked, or things that I found to be good in the episode. So I liked the fact that they implemented Michael Burnham's xenoanthropology curious nature into the plot of this episode. We had talked in the very first episode, the Vulcan Hello discussion, that I had forgotten that, and that I do not recollect that they used her very dangerous curiosity through her expertise as a xenoanthropologist outside of that episode. And she's used it occasionally here and there, but not to the degree of the first episode of Vulcan Hello, in which she puts herself out in dangerous situations because of her curiosity about culture, about her curiosity about how societal structures work, how one can achieve unity and peace. She does that in this episode too, a dangerous degree, but this time round, it doesn't cause us intergalactic war. I actually understand why she goes out of her way, and this episode actually makes me like Michael, because in the midst of the big overarching lurching plot of we must go home, she still has the foresight and the Starfleet nature to step aside and say, no, we need to stop and do the right thing when we can. It reminds me of Janeway in some ways, where Janeway, you know, if she just keeps plowing forward, she could get home and all that, but she will stop out of her way to stop injustice going on, to adhere to the morals and ethics of Starfleet and the Federation and all that, and interact and save people and all of that. And I enjoyed that about this episode. This was an episode that demonstrated that, the double-sided nature of that, of there's the positives and negatives to going out there and stepping away and actually trying to figure out a problem. With this, it was her expertise as a xenoanthropologist was so deadly in regards that she could have got killed instantly. And even when she is discussing the whole thing with the resistance base on the planet, we as the audience can see that Michael Burnham is interested purely from a academic point of view. She's trying to understand it from her specialty point of view, and she's going to understand it from her specialty point of view and try and adapt that and put it back into our universe. Does she actually care about these people, about this resistance? I do think so, but I also think that it is clearly shown through her acting, through the dialogue, through the music, through all of that, that she also is drawn to this conflict because of her expertise, because of her career, because she's going to try and understand how these people have solved an issue that is prevalent in her universe, in our universe, in her life, and she's going to try and fix it. But she also does care about these resistance people, hence she doesn't bomb them, she gives them time, she's mortified when they do get exploded. Stuff that I felt that was missing from Michael in the earlier episodes of this season. I really liked that. There were things that was in that story that I didn't like, but I felt that that actually worked. I have not liked Michael much as a character. I like her in little spurts, but this one, I actually enjoyed that drive in this episode's story. This was a Michael story that I actually felt they did pretty well with. Not the relationship drama stuff with Ash, but the actual away mission and all of that that I just stated. I think that this episode actually does it pretty well. From a script point of view, from an acting point of view, that stuff's pretty well. Like, I don't like the setting, like how the scenes look, but I enjoyed that. I thought that was a positive for this episode. That felt like something I would have seen in a Star Trek episode. That was one of my positives. What do you think about that? Because while saying that, you were kind of frowning and tutting your head. What do you think?
I agree. It is nice that it matters that she's a xenoanthropologist for more than one scene. Like, it matters for the plot. But
but
I also like something.
Yes.
That connects with that, which is that she's somewhat displaying that she was raised by a diplomat and a negotiator.
Who we do meet.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. That is an aspect to the story that unfolds. And Sarek, kind of the good guy Sarek in this universe, who has the evil goatee because they watched Mirror Mirror but forgot the point. Mm-hmm. He basically tells us this stuff.
Yes, he does. But that's my contribution.
I enjoyed that aspect. I like the fact that she also has that conversation with Lorca, in which she calls Lorca out on his what we at the time, and she is to believe, is his unwillingness to adhere to Starfleet directives. He's afraid. He's compromised because he's been tortured all this time, that his judgment has been impaired. I liked that discussion, and I like that. Just to play it out in terms of, let's remove what we know what Lorca's motivation behind that scene is in terms of the long-term goal. Mm-hmm. In the short-term thing of just watching it from the scene, I do like the fact that he compromises and he goes, no, you're right. He's willing to play that up. But we know the reasoning to that is he has a bigger game to play and he doesn't want to fast forward. He doesn't want to have a misstep. So he is willing to keep himself tortured for Michael to go out and do her thing so that he can achieve his long-term goal. And I think it's also because he loves her.
Yeah, he's definitely playing a long game. And particularly in the scene where he's clearly happy, like, Ash is out of the picture, like, your affection for him.
Tyler.
And he's, like, reaching for her hand. And she's just like, okay.
I liked their dynamic in this episode. It was only in two scenes or so, but I enjoyed that back and forth. That was the stuff that I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed the fact that she says pretty much outright that, yes, I'm being an undercover secret asshole, but that I shouldn't have to compromise my shred of humanity. I should go out of my way to do the right thing, even if it blows my cover, even if it costs the mission. That we've seen play time and time and time and time and time again in Star Trek's stories. So many. Yes, this episode could have just been... Yes, this episode is technically a throwaway in terms of that kind of plot. This episode is more about the drama with Ash. But did she have to go out of her way to help the Resistance people? Did we need to see the Resistance people other than, oh, it's a Mirrorverse. What is it like when we see the other side? What does Sarek look like in the Mirrorverse? Like, other than that kind of thing, did we need it? Not really. Not really. But we did need it to show that Michael, although she's losing her thread of humanity from this Mirrorverse, she still has it. And it shows us that she is not like Lorca. As much as Lorca wants to mold her in that way, she is not. And that will play into future episodes, which I'm excited to see.
Excited? Watch more Star Trek?
I'm excited to see how that stuff plays out with Michael and Lorca. Because on my initial watch, I don't know. I didn't feel the Michael-Lorca connection in the way that it unfolds, where he's like, I love you kind of thing. But on this rewatch, I'm noticing it, and I am giving it more praise with that stuff. Although, I feel, I don't know, I'm still iffy, but I want to see how that plays out. So, I was happy with that.
Please, sir, I no longer have my pips, but I'm still Starfleet. Don't force me to slaughter this coalition of hope.
Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm not seeing things clearly.
I also enjoyed within that story, I enjoyed the theological debate that one can have as an audience member, which is these Klingons in this universe, in the Mirror universe and the Tellarites and all of this, they've achieved peace and unity with one another because they are afraid, because they have a common enemy because of the Terran Empire.
It's just the enemy of my enemy is
my friend.
But what happens when that enemy goes away?
And that is the thing I like. And I like that Michael actually says from her career, you know, from her background, well, how come, you know, with your culture, with Kayless and this and that and that, how does it work? I like that that this episode actually delves into these things that we've delved into before in Star Trek, but it delves into it and Interrupted, sure, but it's given enough of a bait for me to chew on and think about after of, well, is there such thing as unity? Is there such thing as peace? When Michael goes back to the real universe, can there really be a peaceful solution to the Klingon crisis? Or is it like this, in which there's a common enemy and that unites people? It's the order chaos kind of thing. And I like the fact that this episode gave us a nugget, gave us enough to chew on in our brain to really get the brain going and going, I don't know. At the end of it, I'm a cynical guy. I think it is that if you've got a common enemy, you'll unite. And that's kind of where my brain lands at the end of this episode. I enjoyed the fact that it actually gave us something to think about like that. Because how many episodes have we gone through of this season in which there wasn't anything like that to chew on afterwards? Pretty much most of the show. Yeah. The things that we chew on afterwards was, that was a weird character choice. Or, why did they do that in that way instead of just easier? Like, that's the kind of stuff that we get stuck on more so than this kind of thing, which is far more engaging to myself. I did also like that the Ash Tyler secret murderer plot was instantly wrapped up with after the episode he killed Hugh. I was so happy that I was still happy because first time when he got transported onto the ship at the end and Saru arrests him, I was like, oh, thank God. I thought he was going to get transported and they're like, Ash, you're back, thank God. And they were going to play that out for drama. I'm glad that they didn't do that. Other positives, I do have others. I am looking for them, though. I have my notes out and I'm like, there's a lot here. I do like that in this episode we do get some good foreshadowing or some good, like, little nods to Lorca being an evil secret arsehole. Just some reaction shots, some choice of words he says. I think Jason Isaacs is just, he nails it. He nails it.
Oh, yeah. We've been singing his praises the whole time.
And that's it.
That's not an issue with him.
That's my positives. I want to just say,
a little one?
Yeah, no, add positives. I want to hear them.
This is a nitpick, really, but a nitpick positive, which is that we see some medical staff doing their job.
That's true. That's true. We got him.
We got two. We got two.
Oh, another thing I want to point out is I like that Saru as a slave saves Michael because she formed a connection with that version of Saru. And also
that is set up. That he walks in without
saying anything.
Because
he doesn't make
him
an entry, like he doesn't make himself known when he enters. Yeah. I appreciate that. Another thing I appreciated is the good version of Saru, like our version of Saru, he is reinforcing and mirroring Michael's thing when Ash gets taken at the end, he's reinforcing that although we're in a perilous land, although we're in a different universe, although we're lost in space, we still are Starfleet and we will abide by our principles no matter what, which is what the intro episode of the series was debating, was tweaking of, do we shoot first? Do we not? Do we compromise our Starfleet principles? And now we're at this stage in which, no, these are the things we need to cling on to.
They bind us. They make us.
And that's something I really liked about this episode too, is another thing to think of. They constantly tell us through lazy exposition and monologues, which I get tired of, but there is something within there, which is what binds us is hope in our universe, these principles of ethics. What binds the people in this universe is fear and stuff like that. And there's this question of, well, what, like, am I, like, what makes me me? What makes me a good person or a bad person? Is it the fact that I'm it basically indoctrinated into some higher system of ethics and code, like ethics and morals and codes? That's something I really like, that they actually do show in the episode. They do tell us a little too heavy with the Terran stuff, but with the Starfleet stuff, they're showing through actions, they're saying it with some dialogue that actually isn't just saying the thesis of the episode or that. I liked that. Because at the end of the day, I wonder that too sometimes. Like, there's a thing of, if there wasn't, like, if I wasn't indoctrinated, if I wasn't grilled into my brain of what's good, what's bad, what would I be like? And the Mirrorverse has the same thing, but they're indoctrinated with the bad, with the fear, with the greed, with the this and that and this and that. I like that this episode brought these things to the forefront and really made me think. We were groaning throughout the episode, but there was things in here that I wasn't groaning at, and I was going, this is actually pretty decent. This is actually pretty good. And maybe I'm measuring on a curve, Rachel, mm-hmm. because I'm just going to say, I think this is the worst episode we've watched of this season.
Yep.
So I maybe these positives are being weighed up higher because of the negatives being so prevalent, mm-hmm. being so in your face.
It's not the worst rated episode, though.
No, because this episode isn't boring.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. The lowest rated episodes are the ones that are considered to be boring, like the Lethe episode, like the one on the blue planet, and then
Parabellum.
And then season two, one of the lowest rated ones is the one where Hugh comes back, and that one, I understand why people rate it low, but we'll get to that when we get to that episode. That is my positives. The fact is, although those are minimum of positives, but those positives, there's more heady thought process in those positives than there has been in most other episodes. So I'm in a weird crossroads with this, because there's like three positives I got, but these positives are things that make my brain click, make my brain whir, make me think about philosophical things or ethics and this. None of the other episodes have really done that. Maybe the one with Lorca and his psychological eval problem in that fifth episode, but that with the Admiral, that's the only other episode thing where I really get my brain clicking into gear about things. But this, like, I'm struggling because this is a terrible episode. But it actually has me thinking.
The humans seek Klingon extinction. They have denied us our rituals, our language. That is why I fight.
The Terrans will not stop until all of their enemies are destroyed.
And a Terran enemy is a Klingon friend.
So you are united by the common adversary.
This episode has two plots. We have the B plot and the A plot. Let's go with the B plot first and what we thought of it.
Where Tilly is trying to
save Pol's life.
Yeah.
And Saru's there too.
Yeah.
To say stuff. What did you think?
It was okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So talk us through.
So basically, Tilly is trying to restore Stamets's brain because part of his brain has taken over and is stealing all of the energy, while the rest of his brain has just basically gone into hibernation.
Okay.
So they...
My brain is hurting from that alone, because I was like, is that what was happening? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Go on.
Because of the micro something that they can see on scans that matches the tardigrade. Whatever. It's not even interesting fake science. It's just a...
Why isn't it?
Explanation. Because they didn't introduce this idea before.
I don't remember this being introduced before.
It is, like...
in a satisfying way, at least. I don't...
Yeah.
My brain can't remember it, like, so it didn't stick.
They introduced the idea of having physical consequences on the tardigrade for forcing it to be the compass in the network.
And we also know that Pol's biological structure and DNA structure has been altered to match some certain properties with that of the tardigrade, or at least it was theorized that was going to be the case. I don't remember if they concretely said that, because that means Hugh would have to be in the plot, but I remember that was a question of, like, hey, has my DNA been altered to that of a tardigrade?
It did say that I think it was the white matter in his brain was shifting, and like hemispheres were merging, and there were being physical consequences. But with the tardigrade, they focused more on the distress rather than the
physical changing.
Because they didn't know
what was
they
happening.
Didn't have a before and after image of the tardigrade's brain, because the previous ship had been using it for all of these jumps, so it's hard to tell,
or at least had experimented on it in some way, shape, or form, because
like, so it's just like, oh, okay, his brain is doing the same thing that the tardigrade was. Let's do this. And then Tilly declares that she's the only person that can treat him.
Yeah, that's the thing that made this plot so befuddling to me. Here's the thing. I'm going to disappoint you, Rachel. What? I thought that this B plot was worse than the A plot. Because he's with the A plot, it
you
has
had
a lot
nice
of mellow.
To say.
I had nice things to say. There was melodrama, but what I can tell you is I understood what was happening at every single moment from beat to beat, from A to B. I understood what was happening. With this plot, they literally spoke so much babble. And then Tilly would babble with medical jargon. None of it makes sense to us because we don't understand the science. Yeah, and they just keep speaking in that Star Trek Discovery way where it's really fast, the camera's zooming around, and then Saru will nod and go, that's brilliant, but have you considered? And they just medical jargon, science jargon. But the big thing was, from the very beginning, I do not understand why Tilly, who is not a doctor, thinks that she can solve this problem, which no one knows the problem. No one knows if it's something that can be solved medically or if it's something that can be solved via her method, which is from an engineering perspective.
Yes.
But we haven't seen anyone try to treat him medically because Hugh is not here and Hugh did not do anything. He's just kind of like, I'm sad and I'm compromised, but we'll talk about that later. From the beginning, I did not understand why this plot existed other than we have no other characters. Tilly is the only one who's worked with Paul that's on the ship, so I guess she has to do it. I don't even believe that she's that expertise in the field that she's doing this. And I don't have any recollection. I do not believe that Tilly has a comprehensive understanding of Paul's work enough to actually solve this problem.
Okay.
I don't. Do you?
I do.
You do.
I do. See, I lost track during the A plot.
Okay.
And maybe that's a reason why I didn't enjoy it as much as you did. But I do enjoy this one more because it's a very grounded problem.
But nothing happens in it.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't say that it was good.
But you liked it more than the one where things actually happened. There was setups and payoffs. This one had nothing. It was Tilly's like, I'm going to try, and then I fucked up.
Excuse me. Don't put words in my mouth.
No, that's me saying that.
I thought all of it was bad. But I am just trying to convey that I didn't dislike the B plot as much as you did.
So why do you think Tilly has a great understanding of Paul's work?
Okay. So I think what she's come to understand, because she was the first one that got to know what was happening with Stamets's brain and how...
Because she was physically there.
Yeah. And because he called her captain.
Yes.
And that gave her unique insight. Because she knows, she's been able to watch Stamets as the changes are affecting him.
Yes, I agree.
But also, she has knowledge of the spores. She works in that lab. She knows the science. She knows the spores. So when it comes to, okay, well, what is going on with Paul? And they do these brain scans. It isn't going to be normal medical science that's going to be able to pull him out of it, because they know that this reaction is because of the mycelial network.
Which she's an expert in.
Which she knows. So she goes, okay, like, oh, she does have a really dumb line, which is like, he is in the network. We need to put the network in.
I have that line too. Yeah. We have his brain is inside the network, so we need to put the network inside of him.
Yeah.
Inside him. And I
Which is effectively what they do by reintroducing external spores to try and bring him back to this particular point and connection with the mycelial network on Discovery.
I'm thinking back. There are points in this season where she does contribute to the furtherment of the mycelial network project, of the spore jumping project. I think I get it a bit hard in my brain to really recognize her as, let's say, the successor to Paul's work, say. Let's say that. Mm-hmm. Because the show has really focused that Michael is the one that has made these big jumps, these big leaps.
But Michael's not on the ship.
But I know she's not on the ship.
So
but
it falls to Tilly.
It falls to Tilly, but there is a thing where I just go, well, it only falls to Tilly because she's the only character that we know. Tilly's just like an ensign, isn't she? She's not a cadet. She's a cadet.
And yeah, she's not even an ensign.
It's like when Wesley Crusher would solve every single problem ever, and you're like, I get what you're doing, but it just threw me off in the episode because there was that thing where it's like, I'm the only one capable of solving this, and I'm like, are you?
Tilly is used in whatever way she's needed.
We have discussed this. Her personality changes from episode to episode. Like, the actress is consistent, but the script isn't.
Whatever they need. If somebody needs to do this, there needs to be somebody else in a scene. Let's put Tilly there.
The lieutenant's health is in the hands of our medical officers.
Medicine isn't working. This is a spore issue, which means no one is more qualified to treat him than I am.
What is the point of this plot in this episode? What does it serve? Other than to fill out time.
Yeah, it does do that. It doesn't even really do that well. So the point of this episode mainly is to show that they are trying to do... They're addressing Stamets' condition. So that it... Because it becomes even more important in the next episode.
We think.
Yeah. From memory. At least, like, in this episode, he meets the mirror universe version of himself when he's in the mycelial network. Mm-hmm. That it's also establishing that Tilly's becoming more confident and is more eager to go after the what's the name of the program?
The commander intern program.
Yeah. The fast track to command that she wants. And that she's able to work with Saru and be more assertive in going after things that she wants.
That's it, isn't it? So, yeah, my big takeaway was the two things, which was...
It's also showing Saru taking a more direct approach to
leadership.
Command.
Yeah, okay. There was things there. There were three things that this B plot brought up that were there. Like you said, Saru being a more direct leader and being a more competent leader than he was previously. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It's played out very minorly, but it is there. The big one is this plot needs to happen so that Tilly can show that she's good enough so that she can get into this program. That's what the big one is. And the other one is hinting at next week, we're going to see the mirror version of Paul. And that's it. Like, that one's like a literal half a second scene. And that's like...
But it's also
a bait scene of, ooh, next week we're going to see that payoff or next episode or the
Paul
one after.
Paul is stuck in the network.
But we knew this already.
But, like, the way... Like, it's not something...
It's not like a brain
it's
issue.
It's demonstrating that it's not fully an external issue. It is something that is going on inside of Paul. They can't pull him out of it. It's not something that they can do. It's something that he has to do.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, why don't they just shock him? Well, that's not going to work.
Yeah, I understand that. I think it's just really, really...
creating a roadblock for a certain storyline.
There's an interesting sci-fi plot in there, but they think to execute the sci-fi plot, every character just needs to speak in babble. And Star Trek as a show has lots of babble, lots of techno-babble. Geordi LaForge's whole entire character is techno-babble.
Oh boy!
I get that. But we make fun of that, and I want to make fun of it here because there's so... Pretty much all the scenes of Tilly and Saru talking is babble. It's just gibberish nonsense to me. I still don't understand what's happening to Paul other than my brain just goes, oh, well, he's been transported to the mycelial network because he fucked up with technology. And basically, it's fantasy. It's fantasy. Yeah. And there's lots of fantastical things in Star Trek that you just have to go, well, you know, that's basically fantasy, but they put a sci-fi spin on it. We've met literal gods in Star Trek, okay? I understand
really
that. But I'm talking about this episode, and that every time that plot came on, I just didn't care, and I didn't understand what was happening, and I just noticed the dialogue was just very, very, we're going to put the network inside of him, and then Saru will nod and go, yes, yes, of course, Tilly, you're a genius, and it was a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And all it served to me primarily was, Tilly needs to show she's brilliant enough to be put into a commandership program. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Was she showing this? Could she have been doing this? Like, was she demonstrating this throughout the whole series enough for Saru? No, no, no. It's this singular episode it demonstrated so Saru could put her in there. And I guess you need a pushing off point, right? You need that, like, that big gotcha moment where the captain of the ship be like, yes, you, that was brilliant. I'm going to promote you or whatever. But even Wesley Crusher, he had seasons in which he proved himself enough so that Captain Picard would, you know, promote him from ensign to officer. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like, oh, that one thing he did. It was so many things that he did.
The acting ensign or whatever they called it.
And
until
was
he
just,
was actually made just an ensign.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, he got a uniform. When he got a uniform.
Yeah, when he got a uniform, an actual rank.
But yeah, that is the B plot. It was just so dull. One thing I got to ask you though, other than Saru at the very end enforcing the Starfleet thing, like I said, what's the connective through line or theme or whatever to the two stories?
It's just that they're both working on, well, Burnham is sort of, but not really, but then Tilly is sort of, but not really, both working on a way to get home. Because they're trying to fix Paul so that he can operate the spore drive, and then Burnham is meant to be trying to get that
ship. You're sticking on narrative connection, but is there any thematic thing connecting the two? Is there any similar echoings or mirrorings of thematic stuff other than what I said is literally at the end Saru just hammers home the we have our Starfleet principles. But they have in previous episodes. They have in previous episodes. Like Choose Your Pain had that kind of stuff mirroring between the two stories.
I'm not saying that they don't give a shit about
doing that. Just in this episode, it just didn't come through.
No.
It was just they needed time to fill up. They needed to hammer home this B plot so that the next episode can happen.
We need to get from here to here. Oh, and I suppose we should do these things. So I guess this is...
Is that a bad thing, though?
No.
For me, it is in this...
Filler episodes are there.
Or filler plot, B plots in episodes. Yep.
They are there for a reason. They serve a purpose. And sometimes even when they are filler, they can still be fun.
Being able to make people laugh or being able to laugh is not the end all and be all of being human.
No. But there is nothing more uniquely human.
Take a shot every time in this episode. The camera will swoosh around and go through the window of a ship into the interior of the ship. You will be dead. You will die of alcohol poisoning because this episode could not...
If you did it with water, it would just drown you. So just don't do it.
They didn't have any eye imagery in this episode, but they sure did. You know how we said eyes are the windows to the soul? Wow, they really took the windows part of that and really went with windows imagery in this episode. Lots of going through windows, and that's what we did in the opening of this episode. We went through the window and we went into the horror movie shot of this episode, which never lines up with what the episode was going
so
for.
The thing that came to my mind in that...
My mind to your mind.
Yeah, there was a mind melt in this episode. It gave us a beautiful mid-episode season recap.
One of three in the episode.
Yeah. Because we needed that.
What
we
happened last time?
I think I really need
those.
Who's this guy again? Anyway, that wasn't my point. Okay, so Ryan has a background in doing drama and plays.
Yes,
this is important for this context. So at university, they were doing like a peer review process with a number of staff from the university reviewing the work in progress of the play that was to be the final assessment.
Yeah. See what we've got.
And the main tech supervisors, one of his comments after one of these work in progress displays. So like they were essentially performing a scene that they'd started to craft.
Yes.
Which
started to craft, you mean no. They were like, in 3 weeks you're gonna be performing this.
Oh yeah. I forgot when this one was in the timeline of things, because I wasn't there. This is just a story that
the continue
I
on.
Do you know where I'm heading with this?
Yes.
Do you wanna...
No, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
So the line that the techie says was, lighting doesn't make a show.
Yeah, the lighting doesn't make a show, and they perform their set without doing the lighting. They're like, we're going to have lighting afterwards.
And that was what I was thinking during that opening, because the only thing that is creating atmosphere is the fact that they're doing flickering lights and lights off.
No. There is some other things to defend that scene. I don't like it, but there's one other thing. There's a few other things. With the benefit, I don't mean to argue with you, but the way the camera moves throughout the scene, like it's like a first person animalistic point of view, like the way it's slithering through the corridors, the way it's slowly Dutch angles, and the menace of hearing very far in the distance a repeated phrase over and over and over and over again, does add a creepy atmosphere to the scene. But what's it in? What's the necessity of it for the episode?
And like,
other than to make all the gays cry because he's a gay man holding his dead lover, it made me want to cry because it was just so fucking insulting. Like, insulting that they did in the first place. But of course, they're playing this for the drama of Paul doesn't know that he's dead, but he does know that he's dead, sort of, because here he is cradling him in his arms, the dead
There's
body.
Other points that I want to make about that scene.
Just wringing that bury your gaze trope for all the emotional exploitation they fucking can.
We need to save that for the Hugh Ryan.
No, we will.
Oh my god. Yeah, but that was what I was thinking during that scene, because I was like, this is in service of nothing, and it really doesn't matter.
No.
And it's just them trying really hard to make a specific tone. And I was just like, okay, you're trying to do something different.
But that tone isn't of what the episode is.
No, and it's not what you're trying to convey about the experience of those characters. Because it shouldn't be horrific. It shouldn't be like he's a monster.
That's
not what we are meant to be feeling towards Stamets. So why are you setting this up?
Because they're going to have the thing where they think he did it. Because
and
they
that's
think
only in one scene. So what's the point?
Because they had a moody, they thought, oh, this will be moody. You know, here's...
And it's also because, like, when she discovers him, she isn't scared, she isn't confused. We don't get a reaction from that random crew member that was doing repairs.
We do, but it's that kind of reaction where we can read anything off of it. Mm. It's that reaction. I'm going to praise something. Context is for kings, that episode.
Yeah.
That episode had a horror aesthetic in the second half of the episode. But the thing that made that work was the aesthetic from the beginning of that episode, throughout the episode, till that point, tonally lined up with the horror aesthetic of the second half of that episode. We were brought onto the ship. We got Lorca with this ominous lighting. Everyone hates Michael. There's this brooding atmosphere throughout the whole episode. So that way, when we get to the Cronenberg body horror stuff at the back half of the third episode, it isn't completely out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stinger. It's the dramatic, stinger of the payoff to the death of a character from a previous episode. It is supposed to be horrific for the sense of how horrific it is that Paul is holding his dead lover in his arms. That's the horror of the scene. And they think the horror of that should be shot like a horror movie.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. And it makes you go, as a viewer, ooh, this episode's going to be brooding on horror and darkness. No, what it is the tone is set up when we meet Michael. That's what the tone of the episode is, which is this looming sense of existential dread of, can I be good if yeah. I'm being bad? That which... is the tone that is set up, and that's set up by Michael. But the tone set up mm-hmm. by this scene, it's only there so that it can ring the exploitative nature out of the bury a gaze trope. That's all it's there for. And it's shot like, I think it's shot like that. There is horror,
yeah.
but it's shot like a horror movie. It doesn't make any sense.
Oh, I just find the whole thing disgusting.
I found it, I remember I looked like, at you and I was just like, what is this? Because we know this goes nowhere in that regard. We know it tonally doesn't go in that direction.
Mm-mm. Not okay.
Not okay.
Not okay. Not here for it.
And just because I just said that, I think the episode, another positive, like what I just said, you kind of looked at me like, yeah, the way that the tone is set up via Michael, it works.
That scene feels right.
The way, I mean, it was it's heavy as it's, well. It's heavy exposition, yeah. but the lighting, the music, and what is actually being discussed is tonally accurate for the episode. Yeah.
Do the Terrans just like sexy underwear more?
Well, this is an issue we will discuss in season two, but there is...
She wears a lot of lingerie comparatively in this episode.
We will mm-hmm. discuss this further in season two, but there is that classic thing of the evil universe has more open sexuality and open promiscuity and all that. They're more openly we fuck kind of thing. Hence we like Lorca because we know he fucks.
Yeah.
So, of course, she has evil lingerie that shows off how attractive the actress is. Because, of course, because in the evil version of the Starfleet universe in which no one has sex ever, or only Kirk has sex, or, you know, like, that kind of thing, the evil version is everyone fucks. I mean, it makes sense. Remember Uhura's outfit in...
Oh, yeah.
They're very sexualized.
I just wanted to bring it up.
How would I describe the uniform? Sexy gladiator... murder gold.
It's basically, like we said, Michael has to make, you know, connections with the resistance. But what the actual plot is Vok finally unleashes his full potential inside of Ash. Tyler dies, Vok lives. That's what the actual plot of this episode is. And it is fucking terrible.
I got really annoyed watching the scene where Michael is down on the planet and she's talking to Red Wolf. Oh my god.
Vok. Before we get to that whole scene, can I just say this sequence mm-hmm. where they're on the Rebel planet and they're in the Rebel base, I said it at the beginning of our discussion of in the Volcanello. I miss when we go to alien planets and they look like alien planets. This is just some fucking desert or quarry and they've put a blue filter over it. And although season two has some ugly ass imagery, this and that set that they're in with the fan and the way it's filtered and the way it's lit, this is the ugliest looking sequence in this whole show. It makes my eyes not hurt, but want to vomit. My eyes. I hate the look of the scene. I don't know why it looks like this. It looks fucking hideous and atrocious. The weird blue filter, the blown out exposure, so everything's fucking ugly to look at. And the fact that it is just this dumbass quarry or desert that they film in. And don't think I don't notice that this is the same location they're going to use in that episode where Michael goes to the Talosian planet. Don't think I don't notice. I noticed at the time. I noticed.
Ryan.
It is just ugly. This is an ugly... That's what I mean. All the stuff I thought of is being blocked by how ugly the scene looks.
But don't you find it endearing when TOS reuses locations?
But theirs are colourful. I know that they're fake. But they're colourful.
Or they've gone to the same spot in the desert.
They've gone to the same spot. Yeah, I'm not saying that, but I expect more from my prestige television show in which they have all this money to blow on CGI.
Which
but they
were made... It was made in... probably 2016 with a decent budget
with a
behind it.
It looks like a movie most of the time, and this looks terrible. It looks like they didn't color correct it. They just, oh my God, it looks ugly as shit.
Booms,
by the way. You got scared by booms.
I got a jump scare by an explosion in this episode. Just after, they point out that, they're going to be attacked, and then they just have this massive explosion. And I reacted, and then I was just embarrassed. I also don't like the way that it is shot outside, but I particularly hate the headquarters set.
Yeah, the Rebel base set, you mean?
I hate it.
With a fan?
I hate it. Because there's a fan at the end, but then, they enter from the side of the building, and they very conveniently have a huge-ass table for everybody to sit at, but people are only sitting on, one end of the table. At least they're sitting on both sides. But then, you get shots, and it's just clearly this doesn't feel like it was all happening at one moment. It feels like,
it feels like it was filmed over several different days and hours.
And it feels like, okay, they did this shot and then that shot and then this shot.
They had to film the fight scene later. And
it wasn't even because, the lining or anything changed. It just feels that clunky. And it's just like, okay, the blocking of this scene is so poorly done.
The blocking of it, the visual of it, and all of that is terrible. Yeah. I think the actual meat of the scene, the discussion, the bringing in Sarek to Mind Meld to confirm that, all of that does actually work, but it's the execution of it.
Yeah.
This is one of the few times where I say the script wasn't the problem here. It was the technical aspect of it.
I looked away. I looked away when, after we get back from the Sarek recap. I just had to look away because I was just like, this is just, I'm just getting too disappointed. And I'm like, I am enjoying what they're saying, but I cannot look at this and enjoy it.
No.
So I'm going to choose just to look away and enjoy the dialogue as much as I can.
Yeah.
And then wait for it to pass. But another thing that I got frustrated with is obviously, since it's our rewatch, I remembered how that particular scene ends.
I forgot.
That sequence ends.
With a fight.
I forgot that it took, it doesn't happen the first time that we see them. It goes back and I was just like, oh, come on, Ash, hurry up and be dumb. I want to get away from this shitty looking scene.
Set, yeah.
I just want to move on.
I have 3 primary things I want to say about that scene.
Mm-hmm.
One, it is very obvious that Ash Tyler is Vok when you hear Vok speak in English.
Mm-hmm.
When he speaks in Klingon, fine. Yeah. And I'm not talking about, we the audience already kind of know, but Michael, he sounds exactly like the dude, all right? 2, the fight scene just needed to happen because they needed an action scene, because they're afraid that we won't understand what's happening unless
we
won't be engaged. We would have lost interest because sci-fi, Star Trek is always about action, obviously, because Kirk did the double punch and he rolls and he made a bazooka out of a twig one time. That's what Star Trek is always about. It's not the conversations.
No.
I also find it funny that the Vok on the planet, mm-hmm. Red Wolf or whatever, he growled. But
you lost.
I lost
your
my shit.
Mind.
But there's 2 things that made me lose it. One, it's clear that he was ADR. It was an ADR growl.
Yeah, he didn't make
the
that
actor.
Voice.
I do not think on set was making a growl. I think he just moved his head, and they're like, "Ooh, we can add a growl here."
Yeah.
That's what, and the noise of the growl was just so fucking funny. It was so funny to hear him go, grrr, and it was just so ludicrously funny. I lost my shit. Ash Tyler starts a fight. He first yells out in Klingon, and then attacks. Michael never questions him about that. She just questions him about, you compromised me.
And
you compromised
mission.
The mission.
Oh, if how could you do this?
Their relationship has not been established enough
to where she would love each other.
I know, but they have not established enough throughout the episodes where it
is
enough.
They say that they love each other and they're both upset with each other. That means they love each other. So that means it's love and
that is the love has blinded her is the excuse. But as I've said, as you've said, we do not buy the relationship is deep enough for that. That if she got transported back, wouldn't you grill him? Wouldn't you figure it out? You know, he spoke Klingon. He started fighting out of nowhere. I think you would understand, right?
I got more angry when he says, like, he's just like, okay, this is what has happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And her answer is,
no.
No.
A very stern no. No. You laughed.
She opened that scene with, like, tell me the truth. I know that something's going on. All of these things have happened. And then he tells her and she's just like, no.
Because she's in love.
And it's just like, oh.
Because she's in love and she's too overwhelmed is the logic. But we don't buy the love. We don't buy the love here.
You have shown
we don't.
That you are not that dumb. That you, like.
But her weakness is, as Sarek has stated, her emotions compromise her. Hence, at the beginning of the series...
Yeah, but Sarek thinks that about every human.
So. But he's not wrong. Her emotions compromised her at the beginning of the show because she wanted to save Georgiou, not actually stop the Klingon conflict. She wanted to save her friend, her mentor, her mother figure, basically. And in this, she's emotionally compromised because of her infatuation and attraction to Tyler. Even Lorca has the kind of thing, well, now that's out of the way, you can finally get to the real stuff. But we don't buy that Shakespearean type love. And this is the big issue of this episode. One word for you, Rachel. One phrase for you, Rachel. Melodramatic.
Nailed it.
This episode could work if there was time built up to it, but let alone that, the thing that could have made this episode work was if it wasn't so melodramatic. So many conversations has the music playing this really intense melodramatic music, or the actors doing this as they talk. How could you? I loved you. Or even this, they talk in whispers all the time when it's serious. If they're not talking like this, how could you do this to me, Ash? It's this. How could That's melodramatic. They're really cranking up the drama.
Command them to stop.
They're really cranking up the drama to the point in which it goes overboard. It reminds you of a soap opera. The whole, you're my tether scene monologue. It's
I need
just
a tether too, Ash.
You said I was your tether. Ash, I need one too. What are you hiding from me?
Because of the lack of chemistry, I found certain moments and certain scenes uncomfortable because they look uncomfortable. Like when it pans out and we see that like she's been lying back on his chest and they're in bed. That's meant to be like warmth, comforting. You should be feeling the connection.
And maybe we're impaired by that because we know it's a betrayal. Later. I mean, they're doing that dialogue where it's like, I trust you. You're the only one I can trust. You're the one I can confide in. I'm not alone because you're here. Then Lorca later is like, you're not alone because I'm here. It's like, we get it. You're going to betray her too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of, can you trust men in this universe? No, men bad, Rachel. Men bad, okay? Do not trust men. They are nothing but secret asshole traitors, okay? You cannot trust me because I'm the secret Nazi spy, all right, Rachel? Although I'm a Polish last name, it's actually a secret Nazi last name. You cannot trust me at all because I'm an evil man who's going to betray you. Except for if you're Saru or Paul, then it's fine. But then if you're Paul, you're going to have a bury your gaze drama trope fest in the second season. And Saru, you're just going to evolve.
Yeah, if you're gay or presumed asexual, you're fine.
If you're gay or have ganglia, you're fine. That's the logic. It is awkward, their relationship, because I feel sorry for her as an actress because we know she can act. We've seen her act in this show. She is a very capable actress. I think the direction and writing lets her down, and maybe some just acting techniques she can use, and she uses a bit too much, like the welling up the tears, the shaky voice, that look on her face when she like furrows her eyebrows and tilts her head to do the kind of Vulcan stuff. She may rely too heavily on that, but what I feel bad about her for in this episode is he is not that good. And I will say it, I do not think he is as capable of an actor, and I do not think he's a good actor. And no matter how good of an actor you have, if they are working off someone who is nowhere close to being as good as they are, let alone if they are bad, it does hamper the performance of the person who is good. So both of them come off bad. Both of them come off as awkward. There is no chemistry we buy, and it is just tough to watch, because not because of the reasons they want us to watch it, but because we're laughing, because we're feeling the false nature of the scenes. We are feeling that these are scenes in a television show instead of being engrossed into the drama of the relationship, instead of being engrossed in the narrative, instead of being engrossed in the story. We are sitting there, as we've said many times, he decided, or the director decided, to show that he's actually transitioning into a Klingon, he is going to crack his neck and make a little growling sound, and he'll do that thing where he drops his brow forward so that you know he's bad now. Lazy as shit. I remember I laughed so hard when that first happened, when we watched it, when it aired.
You still laughed.
I laughed harder at it, though, because it was so bad. It was just, it was beginner level acting trick or director. But since I haven't seen enough of this actor, the guy who plays Ash Tyler's work outside of this, I've only seen it in Star Trek. From what I've seen, he's beginner. Yeah. I don't have enough faith in him as an actor, because all these other people, like Tilly, I haven't seen her in anything else, but she can clearly act. She's given atrocious stuff to work with, but she can clearly act. But him, he brings down so many scenes because of just how basic he is in his choices, whether it's from director or just from him, but he comes off as basic. He comes off as a newbie.
I don't think I'm Ash Tyler, Starfleet Lieutenant. Not really, not anymore.
You're not making sense.
I feel him inside me. His thoughts, his pain, his rage. I tried to shut her out when Lemuel spoke the call. I resisted by thinking of you, the one I want to be human for. And I love.
What makes this episode one of the worst? Is it just that it is so melodramatic and the drama that they are trying to pull from, we just don't buy it because of the previous episodes? Haven't built it up enough? Is that it?
No. For me, it is layers to it. Because it's doing a lot of things that we've complained about in previous episodes. But it's just, and it feels like it's just doubling down on the things that we personally don't enjoy.
It is the Star Trek Discovery format that I stated a few episodes ago that it had finally adopted in its entirety. This is it. This is this is the show. I really thought that on the rewatch that it wouldn't be as like of a big of a brick wall, but it really is. Like Into the Forest I Go, or whatever it was called. That episode was like a brick wall, and now we are just in this. I agree, it's layers of things. It's not just that, but it is bad acting choices. We've got to have action for the sake of action. We've got to bury ideas. We've got to have sci-fi babble that is just there to fill up time. We've got to do this, this, this. This episode has got an ugly-looking scene. It is playing this emotional drama of, ooh, Ash Tyler. But we don't care about Ash Tyler in the way the show wants us to care about
and
Ash Tyler.
And the way that the show is implicitly or explicitly telling us that we should. It's saying Michael is connected to him. You are seeing them in bed together. They are saying, I love you. That means you should care about Ash Tyler and you should be upset like Michael is.
And you're not.
You're not.
I wanted him to die. I wanted him to die so that it would be over.
Oh, yeah. I wrote that down. Like when he says at the end, like,
you should have killed me with honor.
She should have killed me. I wanted to die honorably.
Yeah.
And I just wrote down, I wish they did too.
I think that's all we have to say on it. If we keep going, we'll keep going and going with these small details. Like, I hate the fact that they use slow-mo in that one scene. And you know what I hate more than slow-mo, Rachel?
Bad.
Rachel?
Yeah.
They're finally implementing fully the, what I like to call, the moaning lady. You know how there's always, in dramatic scenes of poignance, there's that lady who moans music in the background, like the kind of, oh, is very quiet in the background because it's serious. We got revealed at the end that the Emperor was Giorgio all along. And I remember when it first aired, I was like, okay, let's see where it goes. My sister was overjoyed because
she's wearing an epic cape.
Epic. That's coat. The word. Epic, yeah. Epic outfit. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Like, what did you remember what you thought at the time? And what do you think now about it being Giorgio? I remembered I was indifferent. I was like, okay, sure. My understanding was, of course it would be. Because we need to see her version. And she would, of course, be the evil emperor. Who else would it be? We've met no other characters that it could be.
Yeah,
my sister was thrilled because she loved Giorgio. Yeah. She wishes the show was about her. And I can't remember what you felt.
Oh, just kind of, it adds up, I guess.
That's what it is, I guess.
And I was just like, okay, I just have to accept this and move on because they won't really do anything with it. It won't really matter until, and then I was like, oh, they're doing this to bring it back, aren't they? Somebody from the Mirrorverse is going to come back with them. And as soon as they introduced Giorgio, I was like, oh,
I didn't even think that
far. She's going to be it.
Well, we'll talk about that when she's more prevalent.
Yeah.
But it could have been one other character, you know? There's one I could think of it could have been.
What?
One of your favorite characters, very prevalent in this episode, actually, sparks that fall off of the roof of the ship. That could have been it. Because that's a very prevalent character in Star Trek Discovery, is those exact same sparks that fall down from any part of the ship. That could have been the evil emperor. That could have been the evil emperor of the Mirrorverse, because you know what they don't like? Light. They have a line where Michael even says, even the light here is different. Yeah, we know, Michael. We'll know for sure later when they tell us the reason as to why. But Rachel?
I think I hear something.
It's the Hugh-dah. We're the Hugh-dah. Hugh is dead. Dead. Except for he won't be, and he isn't technically, but he's dead. Dead.
He's still in this episode, even though he's dead.
This is a segment in which we discuss our favorite character, Hugh Culber, the doctor of the ship. Now, we know for a fact he is not the chief medical officer of the ship. We know this. Mm-hmm. I just really want to reiterate this point.
Yeah.
We know the fact that he doesn't have that power. We know this because they have lines of dialogue that say, Rachel and I know this, but that does not nullify or invalidate our complaints, because the show has presented no one else.
No.
The show has presented
by default
him as the avatar, as the representative, as the medical drama of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So when all these things that the medical side of the ship should be implementing and they don't, and the only person is representative of that is Hugh, the issues do fall upon him. I can't put issues upon a non-existing character. Hugh has been time and time again stated as the guy in charge of the issues that we talked about in our Hugh Dars of previous years, of previous episodes. Years. It feels years. I just want to say that up front. Hugh is in the episode as a dead body.
Yep.
And we really learned a lot because he's in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the forest, yep. Rachel. He's in there.
He can see him.
He can see him, and we'll know what that means next season when Hugh's alive, because Hugh is alive, technically. But how did you feel seeing his dead body being cradled? Okay. Did you feel the horror of the stuff that it wants you to? Did it wring it out of you?
The main thing, I was just like, I was angry at them for milking it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I was angry about was that he just seems to be in a random hallway.
Yeah, well, you know.
Which means...
not a random hallway. The horror hallway.
The horror hallway. Which is not med bay. Not seen to be anywhere near med bay. So, apparently, nobody went into sick bay and was just like, where's the doctor?
Well, Rachel, there's many doctors. We've just met none of them.
We've met none of them. And they seem to not be concerned that after suffering severe damage that, you know, they might need the doctor. Nobody was sent looking for him. She was doing other repairs.
No. It was just so it was so the scene could happen.
Horror hallways needed.
Horror corridor.
Horror hallways needed.
Horror corridor or horror door.
Yeah. Horror door? That really pissed me off because it's just like, this is how little you are showing that the writers care about establishing a sense of a crew.
Now, we did learn something about Hugh. We did learn something about Hugh from a line of dialogue. Of course, not from Hugh. He's dead. Uh-huh. We learned a line about Hugh, which was...
Tilly
says the iconic lines of dialogue of... Basically, they omitted an information to Michael in their report to her about Cole being dead. And
they didn't tell her.
They didn't tell her.
But Tilly thinks that it's unfair
because Colba was her friend and her colleague.
We saw that. We got that. They had scenes together.
To make the point clear, Rachel.
They were together. They talked. That means that they're friends.
I just want to dispel this.
They are on the same ship, so that means that they're colleagues.
I just want to dispel this right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of critiques we make about Q and a lot of critiques we can make about issues like in second season, how come Giorgio can see so clearly in bright light rooms when her eyes are fucked up and whatnot?
She got the surgery.
No. This is the exact thing I'm going to nip in the bud right now.
Yeah.
We are complaining... Hugh and Michael have never demonstrated any form of friendship and they've very minorly interacted as colleagues.
Yes.
I just wanted to spell this right now. Oh, but it's implied with that line of dialogue. We didn't see it on screen, but we, the audience, can just assume that it happened. No. The show wants you to do that exact form of thinking so that you... can cope with the fact that they did not demonstrate that at all in the text of the show. Oh, you can fan theory that. You can make that as an assumption yet. This line serves as that. This line is for you to say, oh, well, I assume that that happened off screen. Okay. But as we have highlighted so many times, this segment exists to prove that Hugh is not a character. Every time he is on screen... has served really no purpose other than just to have him there on screen. They do so much of things, of implying things off screen, or characters say things about him, but we don't demonstrate this with the stuff that we actually see in the episode, which is, by the way, the stuff that actually fucking matters. I will play right now the clips that are in the episodes of Michael and Hugh interacting. And I want, just from these clips, because this is all we get of their relationship, of their dynamic, is this a friendship?
Dr. Culber, I've been studying the creature since it came on board. It's incredibly regenerative. But with each jump Discovery makes, it cries out. In the last 48 hours, it seems sluggish, depressed.
We don't know if it experiences stress or pain like we do.
You think I'm anthropomorphizing?
You discovered how to use the tardigrade for navigation. A victory that maybe isn't a victory anymore, given the creature's deteriorating condition. Let me run some tests.
You should know that Lieutenant Stamets rarely, if ever, listens to me.
I can handle him.
Please, show me how.
It's okay, Brenner. You're in sick bay.
What's the matter with her?
I have no idea.
Vulcans. Tried to murder you.
Renegade Vulcans, a small faction, and they didn't try.
Doctor, they succeeded. I was dead for 3 minutes.
I'm sorry, Dr. Colbert.
Keep it brief.
Thank you.
No, no, it's not a friendship. It's just characters interacting because that is what the script needed those episodes for. But it is not a demonstration of friendship. So this line from Tilly is just an egregious line so that we, the audience, can help cope and justify what they did with Hugh as a character so that they can wring the drama out of it some more. Because, oh no, Michael's not going to find out till later. Michael and him were friends. No, they weren't.
No, it would jeopardize the mission to tell her. Fuck off. Okay, one thing that I got really annoyed with this episode is how much the writers put the burden of creating and developing a relationship on the audience. Because we are told, we don't see, nothing is developed, things happen.
Yeah.
And it's on us to accept what the characters are telling us or to infer things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, okay, they say that they love each other and we saw them in bed together. Thus, they are in love. We should be committed and care about this relationship.
And I can hear right now, it's not that we need this spoon fed to us, because the show's spoon feeding so much to us. It's not that we need this hammered in our fucking faces, but what we need is depth. What we need is complexity. What we need is to see the actual things on screen. That is not to say that things that are implied or things that we as the audience can assume happen aren't valid, but
We also need
to actually see things.
You have
to care,
and the writers have to care about their characters.
It's like if I said right now, nothing. You should care about my opinion because just before this, I saved a baby. Does that change anything? No, you didn't see me save the baby. You don't understand the context of what happened there. I'm just telling you, well, you should care about my opinion as a podcaster because I saved a baby just before I recorded. And I had the brave fortune of being able to record after saving a baby. Now give us a 5-star review. No, that isn't the same. That isn't the same. No. But this is what it wants. But he said it. So it happened. So that means I should care. That means there's depth to it. No, there isn't. I'm just saying, oh, you should care about me because I saved a baby. No. And that's what this is doing. Burdening the relationship, like you said, of, well, we said it and we left it in your hands to imply, get
but,
the implications.
But
Dumbledore's gay. It's up to you to find that out.
But you dumb fucker, you need to be reminded that this holds information. We told you at the start of the episode that this red square that she held up pretty much directly into the lens of the camera holds the data, but she can't encrypt decrypt it herself, and then when Saru pulls it out and holds it to the camera, he tells you again, because in those 30 minutes, you must have forgotten, you dumb fucks.
Rachel, I'll even one up you on this. So, that I was fine enough with, because it showed me, the audience, that, oh, she planted this on Ash. That was actually pretty good.
He just needed to pull it out, he didn't need to say it.
But, you're right with... Oh, well, it's up for you, the audience, to, from this flimsy line of this flimsy passing line that Michael and Hugh had a friendship that we weren't ever going to develop because Hugh's not a character, but because we don't have time. We have 4 flashbacks to put in the episode because you guys need to understand what's happening because you're so fucking dumb. You need to see a flashback so that way when this thing happens, you go, aha, that's what that was.
And this,
but,
this is yeah, within
but you, the
episode,
audience, are so
excluding.
Smart that you can just get implications. They're trying to have it all these different ways, and they're just emphasizing and focusing on all the wrong things.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Your excuse.
Does that include the recap that we skip on Netflix?
Of course that includes the recap, because okay, that takes up 4 minutes. That takes up 4 minutes.
Yeah, that does take up 4 minutes. So there's 3 embedded within the episode, plus the one that you can skip.
That's the one you can skip.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear because I was...
And that's a huge
yep.
There's nothing else to say other than they just want you to... With Hugh, Hugh is just the one minor issue that we've picked on as made a whole segment, but he is emblematic of so many other issues. We're not going to actually put time into it in the actual show. We're just going to make it that we're going to force you, the audience, to have good faith that we put the effort in off screen. And that is lazy writing. How good is stuff like Breaking Bad, like Better Call Saul, like The Sopranos, like True Detective, like these things? Because they do a mixture of both. There's an emphasis on what we don't see on screen, and we, the audience, can get what we like. This is just for, I don't need to explain this. Everyone knows this, but this show doesn't understand that fully, and it tries to cover up its lazy writing or its lack of emphasis on things with this thing of, oh, well, the fans are just going to say, oh, JoJo got her eyes fixed off screen, except for when JoJo doesn't understand the difference between the color. When JoJo says orange, really, fans will go at the same time, well, she's from a different universe, so her understanding of colors are different, except for, and this is what I see all the time. And with Hugh, exact same fucking thing. This line is so egregious, and that's a hooter. Rachel, episode, the wolf inside, yum or yum yum?
Yum.
Yum. Yeah, it's a yum.
Yum.
I said last episode that I enjoyed the Mirrorverse stuff, and that episode last week made me cautious. This episode has plunged it into a, oh no, this is going to be a fucking miserable experience for me. Mm-hmm. I'm still hopeful though, because we're going to get more Lorca, more JoJo. I want to see stuff, I guess. That's all I want. I guess I'm at the stage where I'm accepting that this is Star Trek Discovery. This episode is emblematic of why we feel mixed on this first season. Because remember how the first half of this season wasn't this?
No.
But at the same time, episode 6, we pointed out the foundation was beginning to crack. The issues we are noticing were beginning to come to the light of Kalesh.
Are you ready to hear about the next episode?
Yes.
So this is season 1, episode 12, is called Vaulting Ambition.
Vaulting Ambitions? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The summary, would you like to hear?
Yes.
Burnham heads to the ISS Charon with a special gift for the Emperor, with the help of an unexpected source. Stamets gains clarity while trapped inside the mycelial network. Saru asks Laurel for help.
Not Laurel! My favorite character, Laurel! Rachel, that was us talking about that. Mm-hmm. Where can the listeners find us?
Take a look in that description, or just search generally for Yum Yum Pod, and you will find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, over on Patreon. And if you want to send us an email, it's yumyumpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, yumyumpod@gmail.com, because we want to have a dialogue with people. The social medias, you can hit us up there too. We're always posting some fun stuff on there. Further thoughts on the episodes, questions and queries, just fun stuff, some fun edited material. And on our Patreon, we do have extra content if you feel like supporting the show, and if you're capable of doing that. We have shows on there in which we talk about the best of, like, the top 5 rated episodes of each given Star Trek series and the bottom 5, and we discuss if they're valid or if they're not, and what does it feel like, or we talk about the Star Trek movies, and just extra kind of stuff on there that we're proud of and we're playing around with and all of that. And yeah, the email, yumyumpod@gmail.com. Please email us with your threats, your concerns, your promises, your loves, fears, hates, advice, anything like that. And please share us around, rate and review us. Do the things that podcasts tell you to do.